Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Litton, and I'm the host of Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149. And to indicate you have a question, you just press the number 1 on your telephone keypad and you'll be placed in a queue to be on the air. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. I'm really excited about this show, and there's a lot to discuss. When talking about juvenile justice-related issues, I find most people don't think about how we treat our kids as a human rights issue, but it is. Dignity and freedom are cornerstones in the United States, as reflected through our Constitution and Bill of Rights. There's also the fact that we do consider youth different than adults. It permeates our law and social context. And for the most part, we accept that youth possess a unique capacity for change and growth because they're still cognitively developing. Yet that belief is sometimes abandoned in the criminal justice arena. For example, people are surprised to find out that the United States abolished the death penalty for kids less than 10 years ago, with the United States being one of only 7 countries in the world that actually executed children since 1990. Another surprising fact for many is that while the United States played a pivotal role in drafting the United Nations Convention of the Rights of the Child, which will probably be called CRC through this show, it was adopted in 1989, the United States is still is one of 3 countries left to ratify it. We struggle in this country with issues around children prosecuted as adults, access to counsel, youth placed in adult facilities, the misuse of detention, isolation, shackling, fair sentencing, and the lack of education, mental health care, and reentry services for those in correctional facilities, and the list goes on and on. Both our guests have received numerous awards for their work and have published on topics relevant to our discussion today. Deborah LaBelle is an attorney and writer whose advocacy focuses on the human rights of people in detention, the intersection of race and gender, and the rights of children in the criminal justice and education systems in the United States. In addition to her private practice, Deb is the director of the Juvenile Life Without Parole Initiative for the ACLU of Michigan and the coordinator of Michigan's Juvenile Mitigation Access Committee. She has been the lead counsel in over a dozen class actions that have successfully challenged policies affecting the treatment and sentencing of incarcerated men, women, and children using a human rights framework. She has represented clients before the United States Supreme Court and in international forums with an integrated model for reform utilizing concurrent litigation, documentation, and advocacy strategies. Deb is a senior Soros Justice Fellow and was the first American recognized by Human Rights Watch as a human rights monitor for her work on behalf of incarcerated women and girls. Betsy Clark is currently the founder and the president of the Juvenile Justice Initiative, or JJI, a statewide advocacy organization to promote rational and effective juvenile justice policies in Illinois. The privately funded JJI began in 2000 with a mission to transform the juvenile justice system by reducing reliance on confinement, enhancing fairness for all youth, and developing a comprehensive continuum of community-based resources throughout the state. A few things JJI has successfully advocated for include raising the age of juvenile court, reducing transfers by the elimination of trial of youth charged with drug offense in the adult court, and early appointment of counsel for youth in detention. Betsy previously worked for 6 years as a juvenile justice attorney for the Office of the Cook County Public Defender, and for 15 years served in the office of the State Appellate Defender, including appointments as legislative liaison and juvenile justice coordinator. Among many awards, she was named a Champion for Change in 2009 by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation Model for Change Initiative. So thank you both for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Glad to be here.
Like I said, this is a very interesting topic because in the United States, I think we consider ourselves the human rights watchdog for other countries. But let's talk about this first from an international framework and then turn to how the U.S., in fact, matches up or fails compared to other countries. I tried to make the case why this is a human rights issue, but the two of you live this every day. So, Betsy, maybe you can better explain it than I can. How is the issue of human rights related to criminal and juvenile justice?
Well, it's a big question. And honestly, Lauren, I was pretty unaware of this and a little put off because it seems so complex, international human rights, so many documents, so many rules and agreements and so forth, and just kind of unaware of them throughout my years of practicing law on behalf of juveniles. But bit by bit, we are in Chicago, the home of the world's first juvenile court, and we get a good many international visitors coming through. And my organization gets to meet many of them and speak with them. And bit by bit, I began to be very struck by the fact that everyone that I met coming in from other countries was viewing juvenile justice as first and foremost a human rights issue and looking at particularly the Convention on the Rights of the Child for their sense of fundamental principles to guide their laws and policies and their systems. And I was not that familiar with the Convention on the Rights of the Child, so I began to, as I met these visitors, and these were judges, they were prosecutors, they were defenders, they were probation folk, they were social workers, they were across the board, all extremely familiar with the fundamental international human rights standards for children in conflict with the law. I keep having a difficult time believing that we are not realizing that we're not part of this vigorous debate around the world about how to apply these international standards, and they're powerful. And I think it's really critical whether you're talking about the minimum age of jurisdiction, whether you're talking about 18 is the maximum age of jurisdiction, whether you're talking about keeping kids in the juvenile system rather than in the adult system, or proportionality of sentencing, least restrictive alternative. These are not terribly complex concepts and not outside the framework of our original design for a juvenile court, the whole vision starting here in the U.S., but they are powerful. And by not ratifying particularly the Convention on the Rights of the Child, we are standing outside debates and movements that could be terribly beneficial to our children in this country. That's a long-winded answer to a simple question. Deb, you probably have a different, a much better answer to that, so please.
Well, I don't know if it's better, but I think we start in the U.S., or we now have a pretty fundamental difference in how we treat children in this country. The human rights documents, many of which we have signed and others which we have done what we call ratify, which means we agree that we are going to abide by them, have as their core principle that you know, everyone, once you're human, have certain rights that you can't be taken away based on your status. You have them until you die, and whether you're in prison or whether you're whatever your status economically or gender or race, they are separate and do not decrease your rights as a human being. And so a child is recognized both as a human being and under human rights documents as the future of our social system. And so there are many recognitions of rights of a child that we don't have here. I mean, in the United States, we don't have a document domestically that provides any rights for children. And so internationally, of course, there's a Convention on the Rights of the Child, but there's also, which I think you both indicated that the United States has signed, but is the only country in the United Nations other than Somalia, which doesn't really have a government now, that hasn't ratified it, and meaning that we're going to abide by it. But we have signed and ratified something called the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. We ratified that in 1992, and we said we would obey it. And what that convention says is that youth must be treated consistent with their age and status as children, and that they can only be imprisoned only as a measure of last resort. You can't imprison a child except as a measure of last resort, and when you do, it has to be for the shortest duration necessary to achieve, to bring them back into a rehabilitative state. So what's fundamentally different in this country is that we don't treat children consistent with their status as a child, and we have this odd thing we've started doing which says, based on what you do, we're going to transmorph you from a child to an adult. We can designate you as an adult. We can try you in courts as if you were an adult, even if you're 14 and everyone knows you're a child. We can imprison you in adult prison as an adult under an adult sentence. And that is fundamentally at odds with international law and human rights law. And, you know, some of us would argue that it's fundamentally at odds with the basic U.S. Constitution, that nowhere else, and no other thing, if you can conceptualize this, where does a court or a prosecutor get to say, you are something other than who you are? You're not a citizen, even if you are, and to treat you differently. You are not female, you are not black, you are not white. No other status is changed except for a child, and it's based solely on what's perceived that they've done. And so it's that kind of disconnect that has really got us into deep trouble and have, you know, 100 to 150,000 children in adult prisons and jails in this country.
And before we move on to really examine the issues you're talking about, Deb, some of our problems, are there other, both of you mentioned human rights documents and there was the Convention on the Rights of the Child. Are there other documents or instruments out there that people should be aware of?
Yes, I mean, there's the international, the ICCPR, we call it, and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, but there is also the Convention Against Torture, which has been part of what, you know, observations from the committee to enforce it have been particular commenting on treatment of children in the United States and the long sentences and the solitary confinement of children and the placing them in danger in adult facilities. So has been recognized as torture or other cruel, inhuman, or degrading punishment. There is the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, which has also weighed in, and the committees enforcing that has weighed in with regard to this treatment of youth in conflict with the law in this country, as it has disproportionately fallen on children of color. There are the United Nations standard minimum rules for the treatment of prisoners. There's the UN rules for the protection of juveniles deprived of their liberty. I think those are sort of the central documents that people speak of. Oh, and the Declaration on the Rights of Man, which is something that arose from the United States. It was really primarily the work of Eleanor Roosevelt, and the United States actually participates in the body, the Inter-American Commission, that enforces those rights.
Right. That seems
I know that's a mouthful, but...
No, but I think it's important. It is vast, and they have long titles, and I think there's even guiding instruments by the United Nations on juvenile justice. But this is really to raise awareness so people know what to start looking for.
Right.
Betsy, was there anything you wanted to add to that?
I do think it's important to not be intimidated by the number of instruments that there are. They actually boil down to some fairly simple concepts, most of which are very in tune with the vision of the original juvenile court in this country. But I do want to add to Deb's list something that I use frequently, and that is the European rules, which are about a European rules for juvenile offenders subject to sanctions or measures. And what that is a whole body of very concrete and very visionary suggestions for how to take this complex body of international laws and standards and regulations and apply them in practice with throughout the juvenile justice system. Things like how to make when children are deprived of liberty, how to make their surroundings as home-like as possible, how to instill citizenship in them, how to make sure that they have access to their families, addressing all kinds of very visionary but practical kind of putting in place this whole body of law. And I find that extremely helpful.
I also think it's really, you know, you see the United States as so exceptional in this area. I think that no one would argue that somehow our children are more dangerous, more, any different from any other children around the world. And yet you look at the countries that follow the European model or comply with the convention, and in general, they have had enormous success. I mean, in Finland, you see only 3 people under the age of 18 in any kind of custody. In Germany, there are something less than a dozen. And, you know, in Canada and all of the other countries with large juvenile kids, you don't have this kind of, we have 10 times the amount of children of all of the peer nations combined in prisons. And, you know, it's not working. I mean, so all of our concepts of turning away from the central concepts of treating children like children and recognizing that, you know, the problems that they have arise mostly in social or emotional or behavioral contexts in which they have such a great capacity for change and growth that if you look at it that way, you can actually help them rejoin our citizenry instead of start this kind of incarceration cycle, which has been devastating to our country.
Yeah, I do think it's ironic that we have some of the world's best research on what works. Evidence-based programming and just huge bodies of research on programs and practices in the courts and in the communities that will work best with youth. And those are some of the research, cutting-edge research on brain development, mental health, how to address mental health issues in children in conflict with the law, just really cutting edge, some of it. And that is valuable to the rest of the world. But I think that there is this horrible dichotomy here where we have all this wonderful research and then we don't put it into practice as well as the rest of the world does. And that is the rest of the world because next to the UK, which follows us, we really are the worst in terms of locking up kids at the highest rates of any country. Russia even has had an 87% reduction over the last 10 years, fueled by an intentional de-incarceration strategy. Central and Eastern Europe, I was just in Morocco, much lower levels, and a lot of very intentional work around reentry as well when youth are released. But reentry, diversion at the front end. Often these are countries, that, particularly in Eastern Europe, where they don't have the kinds of community-based resources and programs that we have, or we never have quite enough, but that we have in this country, and yet very intentional de-incarceration policies, and tied, all of them tied, to this proportionality human rights concept, incarceration as a last resort for as short a time as possible.
Go on, Deb.
Betsy, where do you, you know, I sometimes struggle with where the opposition to change is here, because even something as simple as, you know, putting children in adult prisons, which happens in this country with unfortunate regularity, when you look at the list of organizations that oppose it, the Department of Justice here, the American Jail Association, the American Correctional Association, the American Medical Association, it seems like, you know, the Conference on Mayors and Conference on Bishops, the PTA, it seems like everyone invested in children and even in corrections who says, this is a, we know, this is a terrible idea. And any common sense is that if you put a child in a cell with a 35-year-old adult prisoner, you know, that bad things could happen. Very bad things, in fact, do happen. And so where do you see the opposition or the turning this about?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, Devin. Actually, you're right. There's less and less opposition, and I think over the next 5 years, most of these policies that are now increasingly recognized as failed policies are going to begin to just fall away. I do think that we will be keeping most of our children under the age of 18 in the juvenile court within 5 years across the country. I think the will to do this that was fueled by the 90s sort of super predator craze is well behind us. And I think that this huge body of research on what works, the increasing commitment across the country towards restorative justice practices, diverting cases at the front end from even going into court, that is a worldwide trend as well, are really going to rapidly change these policies. But this is being done on a, individual state-by-state basis rather than being tied, and this is what troubles me, rather than being tied to a national commitment to these international principles. And as you said, Deb, we have the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act, but it's pretty modest in comparison to the really full body of human rights in international law, and it needs to be expanded, in my humble view, to include to be consistent with that international body of law, in order to make sure that as we make these changes, that they are sustainable.
Well, I love your optimism. I'm calling from Michigan, which is one of the greatest transgressors in the country in terms of automatically treating youth as young as 14 as adults and putting them directly into adult prisons. And I have not, and we also, you know, we're second in the country in sentencing youth to natural life or life without parole sentences in this country, which the Supreme Court has seen as akin to the death sentence. So, and I see a continuation here of this sort of punishment of children, as if they were adults. And I sort of bemoan the fact that, you know, despite the fact that it completely fails, as we have very high numbers and incarceration rates here, that we haven't seen that the offices of the Department of Justice and the federal agencies really don't have enforcement power to stop it. And I do think that the federal agencies, the Department of Justice, the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Protection Prevention, they both have made fairly public their feeling that these are failed policies, but there is no mechanism really for them to enforce the change throughout with the states.
So I think I want to hear you take maybe one or two of what you think are the most egregious issues that the U.S. needs to be working on as human rights violations, but I wanted to make sure there was nothing else you wanted to add to demonstrate how the U.S. is doing compared to other countries, because I do think that alone raises a lot of awareness. I think people are unaware. They just assume that the United States is probably leading the way and protecting children and doing what's best. And you talked about the rate of incarceration. Are there other things that you want to share with listeners that may really surprise them?
You know, I think Deb really covered it. It's incarceration, the stunningly 18 times the rate of France, 11 times the rate of the UK, which is the closest to us, just shockingly off the charts compared to most of the world. And I don't think that's widely known here, and I don't think it's as widely known in the rest of the world, but our appetite for treating kids as adults is widely known and is found to be really shocking. It's just so contrary to these fundamental principles that other countries are adhering to. And it's like we grow up with a Bill of Rights, and we have a fundamental respect in this country for freedom of assembly and freedom of speech and freedom of, and we may debate here and there, you know, what does it really mean in this context, but this fundamental respect for it. And around the world, there is this fundamental respect for under 18, you're a child, you're treated as a child when you are in conflict with the law. And that view is just lacking here. And I will tell you, it is something that startles me and concerns me greatly in terms of what the rest of the world thinks of us, because I was told recently by a policeman who came over with some judges from a country in Western Africa, he said, we didn't think we would find anybody in the U.S. who respected the human rights of children. And that's really coming from Chicago, the home of the world's first juvenile court. And I'm this very conservative Midwestern girl, and I just find that very, very disturbing and very upsetting. And because I do think we do so much right in this country in our juvenile system for our youth. When we raise the age to bring 17-year-olds charged with misdemeanors back to the juvenile court, our diversion processes are so strong. They just restorative justice diversion. They're all being handled very appropriately. And we do that very well. And we should be doing the rest of it. This is a critical point, to not treat children as adults. It's just so fundamental and so fundamentally wrong. Deb.
I think I would just add on to it. It's not only the incarceration is very different, it's the length of sentences. So,
yeah.
I think the uncontroverted research is that, you know, when children do, you know, bad things, when they break the law, when they do violent even acts, that a lot of it is so deeply connected to their status as children, their impulse control. It's not a matter of right and wrong. It's a matter of, you know, everyone who looks at kids about how they do really stupid reactionary things, how they fall to peer pressure, and how that they don't have the experience or even the physiological development to control certain impulses in certain ways when they're in different contexts. And so everybody agrees that almost 90% of all youth will grow out of those kind of tendencies, and they grow out of them in their early 20s, so that the continued incarceration for very long sentences, and when you see not just life without parole, but 90-year, 80-year, 50-year sentences for youth, it's, you know, other countries say, why would you do that? Why would you spend that kind of money for absolutely no purpose? They don't pose a public safety risk. They've grown up. You've punished them. You know, why would you continue to keep them in a cage? And then, you know, the treatment inside, the issues of solitary mm-hmm. confinement with many countries are, you know, the conventions and the treaties say that's torture to put a child in a cell for 24 hours, 7 days a week, alone and isolated, and that's torture, and we don't torture children, you know. And so that's the treatment once you're inside, I think, is very, very different, and the length of sentences are really at odds. You'll hear, I think, a lot of people look and they'll say, well, there's been a homicide, you know, a child in Britain commits two homicides and their sentence is 7 to 10 years because of the recognition that you can work with that child when they grow up and they'll come back out into society, and they do. I mean, and in, on the other side, you see, you know, children who go into the adult system for long periods of time, as you might expect, they come out pretty traumatized and stumbling and have a very hard time regrouping and joining society. And I, you know, there was just a hearing in front of the Inter-American Commission on March 11th about the issue of youth putting children under the age of 18 in adult prisons, and whether it's a fundamental human rights violation, which they said it was. And one of the commissioners said, you know, interestingly, you know, 15 years ago, the United States sent a commission from the, you know, down to Mexico and said, you know, and found all these violations of youth in the prisons, and we had to comply very shortly. And now we turn around and we see in the United States this is being a routine practice. And so how do you have your moral authority anymore to go to other countries and to prevent, you know, the abuse of children when you're doing something like you're doing? Going back to what Betsy says is that, you know, we want to maintain our moral authority. We deeply want to do that to protect these issues around the world.
And just to follow up on that, when the U.S. Supreme Court issued its decision in Miller saying that life without parole could not be mandatory for a juvenile, I had two human rights lawyers from Kiev in the Ukraine staying with me, and they were stunned. They said, life without parole for a child. They just absolutely couldn't believe it. They said, it's 10 years in the Ukraine. And I just got a paper evaluating the implementation of international standards in European juvenile justice systems, and it says life is theoretically applicable in three countries, however, just theoretically, not really used. Other countries, Portugal, Switzerland, do not allow for longer sentences than 3 or 4 years, and most countries fix the maximum youth prison sentence at 10 years. Again, when I was in Morocco, I asked them 10 years, because I think especially some of these countries that have emerging systems of rule of law, they're not looking to the U.S. juvenile justice system. They're looking to this international body of law, and they're just pulling that down and embedding it in their constitution and in their laws and practices. And so 10 years is kind of the internationally accepted maximum.
And just to let listeners know, in case they don't, they're not familiar with Miller, where you think that the U.S. Supreme Court, Miller v. Alabama, and There was also a companion case that was decided, Jackson v. Hobbs, and that was in June of last year. We're not talking about a long period of time ago that the Supreme Court made a finding that mandatory sentences of life without parole was cruel and unusual punishment for those under 18 at the time that they committed the crimes. And it doesn't apply. I don't know if either of you want to speak about that case a little bit more, because I know, Deb, especially, you're really working on this issue.
Right. We're sort of in the midst of it. So there were, you know, at least 2,500 children serving the sentence in the United States, and now there are two major arguments that are falling from that. I mean, it's a good decision in that it says, you know, children, you have to treat children as children, and before you sentence them, you have to look at, you know, what their environment was, what their, you know, what their involvement is, were they lookouts, were they adults, was it peer pressure, you know, were they coming from a very troubled home environment, were they acting out, what was their mental state, you know, all of the things about a child that you'd want to know, you know, why did they do this, you know, because children, you know, are kids, you know, and so you want to look at, was it impulsive, was it all of the, you know, criteria of looking at what a child is and their attendant circumstances. But then the court said, but you can still give this sentence. It should be rare, but you can still give it. But two questions have come. Does it apply to all the children who are serving this sentence? And states are struggling with that. And two, what kind of sentence can you give? And so you see, you know, proposals in my own state, like Michigan, there has been a proposal by prosecutors that the minimum sentence be 45 years, so that you would consider a child for release when they were 60, after, you know, coming in at 15. And so, which the life expectancy, I must say, of youth in serving those kind of sentences, that's a death sentence. They wouldn't make it that long in general. So even with the court saying you have to give purport, children are always less culpable than adults. You can't treat them the same as adults. There are many states who are now arguing that, okay, we can't give mandatory until you die sentences, so maybe 50 years. I think that is a proposal in one state of minimum, or 35, or, you know, so it's so different than, you know, the 10 years that Betsy's talking about, which, by the way, works. It's not like there's a problem with this. No one says, oh, my God, after 10 years they get out and they're, you know, committing all these crimes. That's not what happens. And that's, we know that that's not what happens. We know that if we look at, like, civil liberties issues, we always say, you know, kids under 18 don't have all these rights. They can't vote. They can't do all of these things because they're less responsible. They're not as formed. You know, but when they grow up, I mean, you don't let them drive at 14, but you do let them drive when they become 18, and you let them grow up. And so it's the same thing that happens here. We know that when they mess up at this age, that they grow up, and they grow into, you know, people who can certainly come out and join society, but we haven't got to that point yet, and we really need to urge this. And I also think that other countries have not missed the fact that class and race play a big part of who goes to the prisons and who goes to treatment centers that can be afforded.
So I really do want to turn to what we can be doing here. But I want to remind our listeners first that if they have a question, they can pose it, type it in the chat room, or they can call 347-994-1149, and you're going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad, and you'll be placed in a queue. So continuing on, Devin, what you're talking about, you have argued these cases, and you've used a human rights framework. And so perhaps you can share, because we do have a lot of legal advocates that listen to the show, what are some recommendations you have for attorneys who are meeting with you? What should they be looking for? I'm sure you must be shocking some judges in front of you who've never thought of it in this way. So any tips that you can be sharing would be appreciated.
So when we file challenges, and under 1983, the Civil Rights Act, we have argued that the Civil Rights Act allows for the enforcement of treaties as well as any other laws. And so we always include a human rights claim, and that these are violations of treaties that we've signed and ratified, and that we argue a jus cogens, that this is the standard, this is an accepted standard that has been adopted by the world, and therefore there is a violation in our own law when this standard has become normalized throughout the world. And these are, I think that in addition to just arguing that the United States should be bound by these treaties as part of their law, that I think that it's crucial for judges to understand what the rest of the world is doing and what's possible. So sometimes you have, for example, you know, you might have a Department of Correction saying, well, we can't really do that. You know, that's not possible. We can't separate youth from adults. We can't treat them differently. We must use solitary confinement. And you say, well, you know, the rest of the world manages it in this way, and they have corrections facilities, and Canada doesn't do it. And you can talk about best practices to undermine the fact that, you know, just because this is the way it's been done doesn't mean that it is either from a safety or a economic standpoint impossible to do. And so setting the tone, looking at the remedial issues, you know, has been crucial in terms of changing things. When you were talking, one of the frameworks that we used with regard to women in a case that we did involving sexual abuse of women was that you have to follow the norms in which women cannot be supervised by male staff in detention, which is a standard norm in international law. And so that had never been done here in the United States, but by urging that that is the way we have to go, that's the remedy that we have to move toward for issues of dignity and inherent privacy issues, that was what we got in the end. After, you know, showing documents from Canada and other peer country, people regarded as peer countries that had similar laws. And so I think that it's crucial to bring this to the table and start to get people to look at, well, why do we do it differently? And what is the value of us doing it differently? I mean, sometimes we do things differently, and it's wonderful, a good thing we do. But in many ways where it's a failed policy and we're, you know, cycling children in and out of prison because we've started to treat them in the very beginning not as our hope and not as, you know, children who can learn, but we tell them they're irredeemable and that they're horrible, and, you know, then expect them to turn around, which is very difficult for a child. You know, I'm just going to say this on the side, and, you know, we recognize in this country, it's been so odd to me that, you know, children, if they're bullied and, you know, treated poorly in a classroom, that it sometimes has devastating effects. You know, we recognize that suicide is not impossible or out of the realm. But for these children, telling them that what they've done is so awful that they're going to go to an adult prison and you have to understand psychologically what that does to them. And we have to learn to treat them with, you know, this status that they are and help them, not punish them and bringing them back in. And I think that using that whole framework of inherent dignity and rights is, and the language is very important when you do this litigation. You can't talk about convicts, juveniles, inmates, you know, those of us who were at or listened to the Miller argument from the Supreme Court knew that we were going to win because almost all of the justices spoke of children. And that was very different even from 5 years earlier, you know, when they were talking, you know, or in 2005 when they talked about juveniles and delinquents. And once you talk about children, it's very hard to do these terrible things to children.
Mm-hmm. Betsy. We had a question. I think it's kind of similar to the question that Deb posed to you, but you can build off of it, which was, you know, what is it going to take for the United States to ratify the Convention of the Rights of the Child? And the second part of the question is, what can we do to help? So maybe you can talk about what are you seeing as far as trends across the country. You mentioned that. Are there things coming from internationally to the U.S.? How can we engage our communities around this?
Well, I do think that bit by bit we are embedding these human rights principles in our laws and practices. So, for example, the campaigns to raise the age of juvenile court to 18, there are only a dozen states left. Illinois is fingers crossed. We have our bill to finish that pending in the Senate, past the House now. And at least in Illinois, we have passed two resolutions, one in the city of Chicago and one in the House of Representatives, that both urge the city and the state to abide by international human rights laws for children in conflict with the law. And so piece by piece, kind of embedding these principles. 2 years ago, we promoted a law based on international human rights standards to embed in our Juvenile Court Act the language least restrictive alternative, that commitment to state juvenile prison should be the last resort, and done only when we've exhausted all reasonable means to keep youth at home. And I think the more you embed these principles in our state laws, the better off we're going to be. But I think it really is critical as we do this to keep tying it. And it's not the central argument yet. It's not the one that pushes the bill through. But to keep tying every change to this rich international body of human rights law. And by the way, we are not only one of only 12 states that prosecutes kids under 18 as adults, but we are the only country in the world that does that. Just keep pointing this out that the rest of the world abides by this other body of law. And along with all of the... So at each point that we have an initiative, we try to tie it to international human rights, and we try to educate folks as we go along about the value in complying with just these fundamental human rights for children in conflict with the law. But I feel that unless as a nation we have a really serious push to ratify the convention, highlight, we are outside of this whole very rich body of discussion. Right now there is a push to promote, for example, in addition to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, an optional protocol that would allow nations that have ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child, when their own systems aren't quite enough for that last push, to come into compliance on some point, for example, trying youth under 18 as juveniles, to have an international body that they can go to under the convention. And that's a big push in the international community, and we are not part of that because we haven't ratified the convention. I want to get back to what Deb said about conditions of confinement that really are so shocking to foreign visitors when they come here. And that does seriously undermine our credibility on human rights. I mean, we need freedom of association, freedom of speech around the world, and it undermines our promotion of those human rights to have the world know how we treat our children that come in conflict with the law. One suggestion that was made at the last Juvenile Justice Observatory Conference, International Juvenile Justice Observatory Conference, was that every nation created ombudsman with right of 24/7 access to all youth facilities to develop you know, adherence from each country to uniform practices and standards. And it would be terrific if we could, in the U.S., be part of that whole community. It was, tying back to what Deb said in the beginning, the convention was written here in the U.S. In fact, when we went to the House of Representatives and asked, tried to get bipartisan sponsorship for this resolution to comply with the convention, the Republican sponsor said, oh, sure, I'll sign on. My grandmother helped draft that here in the U.S. So we have a long history, proud history, with the juvenile court, the creation, with the drafting of the convention here in this country. We must work for ratification of it. We can't be one of three nations that haven't ratified. We must ratify it.
And I also think for people who are litigating on these issues, I do think that as the effort has been made for 10 years now, when these issues came before the U.S. Supreme Court, the amicus briefs that were filed pointed out first in Roper when it considered abolishing the death penalty for older youth, 16 and 17-year-olds, there was a lot of submission of briefs talking about international standards and where the United States was so exceptional to these standards. And there were also in the Miller case and in the earlier Graham case, which abolished life without parole for youth who did not commit a homicide crime, there were submissions by international jurists from the European Jurist Association and other people around the world saying, listen, you don't have to do this. This is how we handle it in this country. We have a whole different process, and this is how successful it's been. And so I think that continuing to remind courts, even at the state level, those who are practicing on basic juvenile detention issues, it's very important to start bringing these issues before the courts, and there's a rich body in the amicus briefs that people can look to. We are now in the year of what's called the fourth periodic report that the United States has to do to respond to issues of noncompliance, and there are issues involving youth that the State Department will be preparing papers on and saying, here's what we do, here's where we're in violation. And many NGOs in this country will be filing what's called shadow reports saying, well, you know, not so quick. Here's some significant problems in how we're not complying. And I think that there's a rich body of documents out there, and it's important, even if it's not your central argument, Betsy says, to remind courts that there are other ways and that they need to start thinking about why they're doing it in a way that's so different from the rest of the world and so ultimately destructive to our children.
Are there resources or places that our listeners can go to find those reports or other information to further educate themselves about this issue?
Actually, the National Juvenile Defenders Center has a wonderful document that summarizes for juvenile justice the application of international laws and principles and specific things that juvenile defenders can do. And you can pull that down at the National Juvenile Defender Center website.
NJDC.info.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Right. And some of the others, the Campaign for Youth Justice is a good place to look at where a lot of the trends, the state trends, they put out a very good document this year in terms of where state trends are, so that if you want to even look for best practices within the United States, if you're in a state or an area in which you can't get a judge to look internationally, but you at least want to look to best practices within this country, states that are moving to and adhering to that, that's a very helpful place. And then both the ACLU Human Rights If you go to the ACLU site and go to the Human Rights Division, they have it. And Human Rights Watch has a very good site, too, with regard to juvenile and children's rights.
Terrific. Well, we're at final thoughts. So maybe within those you can kind of include what are your hopes for where the United States will be in the next 5 to 10 years. Let's say we've ratified. What are some of our next steps?
Well, I do very much hope that we will ratify the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and then I would like to see many of these key principles embedded within the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act, so that we have that not only the ratification, but a national governing standard as well. And the other thing is, I hope that as we back away from incarceration, we are decreasing our commitments of youth dramatically across the country, that we also make equal strides in improving conditions for those who remain, which are really appalling. So the youth that are stuck in the adult system with these horribly long sentences, that we make strides and changing that.
So I would really hope on both ends. I would hope on the front end that we would stop, you know, criminalizing really behavior in the schools, that we would stop having youth treated, you know, that do youthful acts, impulsive acts, that we would stop making that criminal, and that we would, for all youth under the age of 18, that we would treat their actions consistent with their status and not put them in adult facilities and not treat them as adults under any circumstances. And then even if there is a sentence that requires longer than the age of 21, that they do not go into adult prisons, that they're maintained in juvenile facilities across this country until they reach the age of majority. So I hope that with the Supreme Court's guidance, that more and more states will take up the treatment of children in a way that, you know, use incarceration as a last resort and use the resources to go into juvenile justice facilities and treatment and education centers, and to see if we can slowly turn away and pull our kids out of the cycle of incarceration that they're on.
Betsy and Deb, thank you so much for being here. Hopefully maybe we can have you back on so we can say that the United States has ratified the convention, and then also end this legacy of treating kids as adults.
You so much for your concern on this issue.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Lauren.
Mm-hmm. Our next show will discuss the intersection of human trafficking and juvenile justice, highlighting legislation that has been passed in Ohio and one community's response to kids who've been trafficked for sex. To stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at www.childrenslawky.org. Take care and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth. Thank you.